When new environmental studies come out about fracking or air pollution, it's a journalist's job to take a closer look.
People often think, oh, that's just a daily story and I can just call the researcher and put it out there. And it's not. It's not a political story. It's not he said, she said.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the perils and responsibilities of reporting on science. And speaking of studies, a new one shows widespread contamination of water from coal ash.
So they dumped it in unlined pits, frequently in contact with groundwater, and they just kept filling them up for decades, and this is the end result.
Plus, two retirees find friendship in birdwatching.
Good friends, fellow birders, and fellow birders and friends are the best kind.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Researchers in Pittsburgh think they might have a way to bring down the price of so-called clean coal technology. The idea is to capture carbon dioxide from coal-fired power plants and store it underground as a way to address climate change. Chris Wilmer with the University of Pittsburgh has modeled millions of sponge-like membranes. He says they would filter a power plant's exhaust gas.
And if they work well, what you would end up with coming out one side is mostly just nitrogen gas, which is fine to emit into the air. And on one of the other exhausts, you'd have mostly CO2.
Wilmer says this technology is less energy intensive than other carbon capture methods, which helps to keep the price down. Pennsylvania lawmakers remain skeptical about a provision in Governor Tom Wolf's budget plan to transfer money out of special environmental funds to fill funding gaps. WITF's Katie Meyer reports, like the rest of the proposal, it will ultimately need House and Senate authorization.
Wolf's plan has been a consistent point of contention in budget hearings with environmental agencies. The multi-year series of transfers would cut general fund contributions to two environmental agencies by tens of millions of dollars. The holes would be filled with cash from off-budget funds that are supposed to be used for things like municipal recycling and community revitalization. GOP Senate Appropriations Committee Chair Pat Brown didn't say he opposes the idea, but ended a recent hearing with a note of caution.
Not having predictability in environmental protection is a dangerous thing, and it's what we have available now based on the revenue capacity of the Commonwealth, but going forward, there'll need to be a serious conversation about how we fund these very important operations.
Republicans have proposed similar maneuvers in the past, but Wolf has always shot them down. Department of Environmental Protection Secretary Patrick McDonnell says in the coming year he doesn't expect the transfers to affect operations. They'll just make things a little tighter. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
A public lands bill that passed Congress recently extends the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail by 1,200 miles. 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports that the route will now begin in Pittsburgh.
Many history textbooks teach the expedition of Lewis and Clark as a story about the western United States. The men set out from Missouri across the newly purchased Louisiana Territory in 1804. The National Park Service administers a historic trail along that route, made up of interpretive signs, visitor centers, and recreation areas. Now Congress has designated an extension up the Mississippi and Ohio rivers to Pittsburgh, where Meriwether Lewis departed by boat in 1803 to meet William Clark. Paige Cruz is with the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation.
A lot of facilities already exist along the Ohio River that have to do with Lewis and Clark.
Soon, another will appear in Pittsburgh. An interpretive sign will go in this summer on Mount Washington, overlooking Bruno Island. Lewis stopped there to show off his gun to a crowd assembled to see him off. It accidentally discharged and narrowly avoided killing a woman on the first day of his journey. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Amy Sisk.
A new report finds coal ash pollution is leaking into groundwater at 9 power plants around Pennsylvania and over 200 nationwide. Coal ash is the waste from combustion at these coal-fired power plants. The report from the Environmental Integrity Project and Earth Justice found over 90% of the sites that store coal ash are leaking levels of contamination that exceed EPA health standards. Here to talk about the report is the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier. Hi, Reed.
Hello, Kara.
So when we say that coal ash waste is leaking, where is it being stored and how is it getting out?
So there's two main ways that utilities have traditionally stored coal ash. One is in a lagoon, kind of like mix it with water and put it into these artificial ponds. There's a huge coal ash impoundment on the Pennsylvania-West Virginia border that is called Little Blue, and it's the largest coal ash pond east of the Mississippi, I believe. It's in the process of closing. So that's one classic way to store coal ash. The other is in landfills, and in the same way that you would, you know, layer trash in a landfill, you layer coal ash. So there's wet and there's dry. Recent rules passed by the federal government require utilities to store coal ash in a landfill or an ash pond that is lined. In other words, it's got like a thick plastic liner underneath and layers of clay so that what's in the coal ash doesn't leak out into the groundwater. But the vast majority of plants have these unlined landfills and ash ponds from decades ago, and that's where the vast majority of coal ash goes today. Here's the study's lead author, Abel Russ. He's an attorney with the Environmental Integrity Project. And here's what he says about how coal ash is generally stored.
So they dumped it in unlined pits frequently in contact with groundwater, and they just kept filling them up for decades. And this is the end result.
So the report that the Environmental Integrity Project did was examining data from 265 coal plants or offsite disposal areas, and that included over 550 impoundments and landfills nationwide.
So what's the public health concern over coal ash waste in groundwater? Is it as bad as it sounds?
It's not great. You know, coal ash is the remnants of what you get left over when you burn coal, as the name would imply. And coal contains a lot of naturally occurring metals and elements. But when they're concentrated the way they would be in ash after you burn all this stuff, it's hazardous to your health. At one former coal plant near Pittsburgh, up in Newcastle, arsenic levels in the groundwater are 372 times what the EPA says is safe for drinking water. Though groundwater near these sites isn't necessarily used for drinking water, the contaminants could migrate to underground drinking wells, into rivers and streams. And eventually, like if it gets into a river like the Ohio, it could make its way to public drinking water systems. There's lots of stuff in this coal ash. But arsenic, for instance, is a neurotoxin. It can impair development in children and lower their IQ. And it also has been linked to several types of cancers.
You mentioned the facility in Newcastle, the Newcastle Generating Station in Taylor Township, which is in Lawrence County, north of Pittsburgh. Was one of the worst offenders in the report. What can you tell me about that facility?
Yeah, well, this power plant actually converted to natural gas in 2016, but it still has on site a 57-acre coal ash landfill and a 2-acre coal ash pond. And according to the documents that the report's authors were able to dig up, parts of the landfill are lined, as is required under modern, you know, regulations. But parts of the landfill were built on top of an old unlined landfill. And beneath it, the groundwater tested at 3,700 some parts per billion of arsenic. The EPA's maximum load for drinking water standards is 10 parts per billion. So there were also several types of other contaminants. Lithium, for instance, was at over 50 times federal health-based guidelines, and there were unsafe levels of boron, cobalt, molybdenum, and sulfate. We tried to reach officials from Genon, the owner of the power plant, and didn't hear back from them.
This sounds like a long-term problem. Why is this information just coming out now?
I mentioned that recent regulation on coal ash. That came in response to a very big coal ash spill in eastern Tennessee in 2008. One of the things that came out in this 2015 coal ash rule from the Obama administration is that for the first time, these facilities would have to monitor the groundwater beneath them and also, importantly, report that data to the public. This is really the first time that anyone's been able to sort of take all the data and compare it to what the EPA says is a safe level.
What are the federal EPA and the State Department of Environmental Protection doing about coal ash pollution? How are they responding to this report?
Well, I asked for a response from both agencies, and they both say they're reviewing the reports. Both agencies say that the contamination reported here is not necessarily the same thing as what people are ingesting in their drinking water or what's getting into rivers and streams. And the EPA stresses that the monitoring data used in the report is only sort of one part of the process. Eventually, if these facilities are found to be threatening drinking water supplies, for instance, they will have to be closed and sort of dealt with, cleaned up. The DEP says it has stricter rules than the EPA's when it comes to coal ash, which isn't surprising. We're a big coal state, so we burn a lot of coal historically. And they say that when pollution is noticed in groundwater monitors at sites in the state, in Pennsylvania, there's an evaluation and assessment process that's triggered, and this can also include cleaning up a site. And another thing that the DEP likes to stress is that public drinking water supplies, like those located along major rivers, have to test for a lot of the pollutants found in coal ash, including arsenic. I should say that last year, the Trump administration rolled back parts of that 2015 coal ash rule, making it easier for companies to get waivers for some of those groundwater monitoring requirements and delay closing some unlined facilities or those built too close to underground aquifers, which is another aspect of the 2015 rule.
What does industry say about the report?
I talked to Jim Rower, who's the executive director of the Utility Solid Waste Activities Group, which represents utilities that have to deal with solid waste. It's basically an industry coal ash group. And he said that the groundwater data that's used in the report, you know, only represents the groundwater at the very, very edge of coal ash storage sites, and that nobody is going to, you know, build a drinking well at the edge of a coal ash storage site. But he didn't dispute the results that the environmental groups were publicizing. He basically said that the report showed that the regulations on coal ash are working. If the facilities identified in the report are found to be threatening drinking water supplies, for instance, they're going to have to close. And here's a little bit about what he said on that.
You know, we care about protecting the environment, managing our coal ash in an appropriate manner, reporting that to the public. And I think the data that are out there, the data that built these reports from the environmental groups are evidence that the rule is working.
And I want to come back to that 2015 coal ash rule. You know, you might be thinking coal ash, it's got arsenic, lead, mercury, it's got all these bad things in it. Why isn't it considered a hazardous waste by the EPA? And the reason is the EPA had a chance to treat it like hazardous waste, which would imply stricter regulations and more expensive regulations for the industry. And when it was coming out with that 2015 coal ash rule, it decided not to consider it hazardous waste. So that was a decision that was a pretty controversial decision for environmental groups. And it's a bit of a compromise because there are stricter standards for coal ash than there used to be, but it could have been stricter if it had been considered a hazardous waste.
Reid Frazier covers energy for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. Thanks, Reid.
Thank you.
There's a link to the Environmental Integrity Project's report and more of our reporting on coal ash at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. New scientific studies and reports can be exciting, even alarming, and not all they're cracked up to be.
Who stands to gain from this research? Who stands to gain from you doing a story about this quote-unquote breakthrough?
Later on the Allegheny Front, how journalists and you can cut through the spin and find out what environmental research really means. Stay with us. When you just start out in birding, you get yourself a good pair of binoculars, a guide to birds, and some sturdy footwear. But something else you might want to have is a mentor. That's how the tradition and passion for birdwatching is passed on. For our series Wild PA, writer Lori Gravina talked with two members of the Three Rivers Birding Club, who illustrate this point perfectly. She met with them on a cold, windy day at Harrison Hills Park in Allegheny County.
I don't hear any birds or see any birds at the moment. They're hunkered down in the brush, I guess.
Paul Hess sits at a picnic bench with his cane leaning at his side and his gloved hands folded in front of him. And he's always looking up, scanning for birds.
Soon they'll be out because they need to eat. The colder it gets, the more they need to eat to keep their energy going, so they'll be around.
Back in 2001, Hess was one of the founding members of the Three Rivers Birding Club, but he's been birding since he was a kid.
I'm very old, and I've been birding in the East since 1970, and I've seen more than 600 different kinds of birds in North America.
Hess is actually 78. He's a retired editor of the Valley News Dispatch newspaper, but it's a busy retirement. He's written more than 300 articles for Birding Magazine, contributed 2 chapters to the Complete Birds of North America, and wrote the National Geographic Field Guide to Birds of Pennsylvania.
I respect Paul for all that he's learned and all that he's done in the world of birding. He has sort of legendary status in the birding world.
That's Dave Brook. He's newer to the birding scene. It was just 4 years ago that he went on his first bird walk at Harrison Hills and saw the hooded warbler, a brilliant yellow bird with what looks like a black hood. Brooks says he was shocked to see something that colorful at a local park.
And that was the very first walk I ever went on that sort of ignited my world of realizing that, wow, this is something people do. They go out and walk around the woods and look for birds? Really?
That's the first time Brooke met Hess. Now, they're friends.
We've now had a chance to go out together and, take some walks, and he's tried to impart some of his knowledge on me, which some of it's taken. I'm a little...
You're a fast learner.
I'm just not as smart as him, so there's only so much I can absorb.
I should say this, though, that when Dave does ask me if this is some kind of bird, he's always right. He gets it right.
I'm selective in the questions I ask, so as not to look too dumb. It's one of the issues when you retire from a career. I worked for 43 years for the same company, and over that period of time, you develop relationships with the people that you work with, and then you retire, and you very quickly dissolve away from those people, and they are not part of your life anymore. So I've, in 2 years, have essentially entered into a whole new world, and...
What do you see?
Red-tailed hawk.
Harrison Hills Park is known for its birds. It's part of an Audubon, Pennsylvania's important bird area. There are woodlands, vast open fields, meadows, and a large pond. The 500-acre park sits on a high ridge above the Allegheny River, so there's a steady stream of migrating birds.
I count them. I don't just look at them for fun. I count them, see which ones are nesting where, and when they come and go and disappear, and when they arrive in the spring, when they leave in the fall. All those kinds of information I record and I keep.
It's this kind of dedication that Hess is passing on, and Brooke is more than ready. He's already at the park 3 to 4 days a week and admits he's a little obsessed.
It's so much fun to go out and just to see whether you can see what's happening in the park. You could sit at home and be depressed by the news, or you could come out in nature and really lose yourself in the beauty of nature. A day like this, it's not a beautiful day, but you know what? Once you get out in it, you find something that makes it good.
Hess and Brooke sum up their friendship this way.
So it's just a privilege to get out with him and have a chance to get to know him and pick up some of his knowledge.
Good friends, fellow birders and friends are the best kind.
If you find yourself at Harrison Hills Park, stop by the Environmental Center and pick up a copy of The Birds of Harrison Hills, a checklist that Hess compiled. You might even see Hess and Brooke out there together, searching the sky for that next bird. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Laurie Gravina.
For more stories in our series Wild PA about wildlife and conservation, head to our website, alleghenyfront.org/wildpa. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holzapfel. We heard heard earlier in the show about a disturbing new report on coal ash contamination in groundwater. And a lot of environmental reporting starts with new data, scientific studies, and reports. How journalists evaluate and use those resources to inform the public is the subject of an episode of the State Impact Pennsylvania podcast, Energy Explained. State Impact's Amy Sisk talks with two reporters who've covered studies tied to fracking and health. Susan Phillips, who's based at WHYY in Philadelphia and is also with State Impact Pennsylvania, and Alana Gordon, a Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT.
As reporters, we get a lot of emails and phone calls with story tips, and there's a lot of new research that comes across our radar. So when you get word that a new scientific study has come out, I'm curious what you guys do to evaluate it, and how do you even know that it's newsworthy? Alana, let's start with you.
Well, I think it's really easy to get new studies and have the urge to want to report on them as news because, hey, these researchers did this thing and, hey, there are these findings. So at first glance, it's a very tempting and easy thing to report on a study as kind of a one-off news story, but it depends on whether it's in my wheelhouse of area of interest and coverage to know whether or not, oh, that's interesting, that kind of builds on some previous understandings or that challenges that. But within the study itself, I mean, I think that there are questions to look at in terms of what journal has it been published in, looking at the study itself beyond what the press release says. That's a big one. How big is the study? There's a lot of incentive, depending on where a study comes out from, of the newness of the breakthroughs to capture, you know, a broader general attention. But science is incremental, and so sometimes it's looking for keywords to be looking out for.
Susan, how do you vet new research that you hear about?
I agree with everything that Alana just said, and I think that it's really important to understand that it's actually a lot harder than you think to turn around a story about a study. I mean, people often think, oh, that's just a daily story and I can just call the researcher and put it out there. And it's not. Okay, it's not. It's not a political story. It's not he said, she said. What you want to know is it in a peer-reviewed journal that's a well-known journal that you have respect for? Do you know the researchers? I mean, a lot of times if I know the researchers and I have vetted them prior to this, then I just have more trust in what they're saying and what they're doing. And then the other thing that you really want to look at is who funded the study.
There's a good example. Can I chime in on that?
Yeah.
Where often when there's contentious topics like in public health and you get a press release or a new study that shows the benefits of salt and then you realize it's by like the Salt Industry Association, you might want to like put a little more scrutiny into what the claims are, what the interests are in results turning to a certain way.
Right. And you also want to make sure that you're doing this for a general audience and you don't want to distort the information for them. You know, in my field, fracking, for instance, is fracking good or fracking bad? Does fracking pollute the water? Does it not pollute the water? And there's nothing out there that says either one of those. They're all very nuanced and built on a base of research that, especially for fracking, started happening sort of late in the game. And so fracking started coming to Pennsylvania before there was a lot of research on the impacts of water or the impacts of health. And so it's almost like the research community was sort of playing catch up.
In the course of your reporting, particularly on, you know, fracking and the public health impacts, I've noticed that you often reach out to researchers who were not involved in those studies to get their take. And can you talk a bit more about why you do that and why it's important to do that?
Well, it's like any balanced story, right? You don't want to do a story with one source where one person is saying one thing and you don't go and check it. You don't cover crime and just do what the police say. We hold up peer review as sort of the gold standard. I mean, there's a lot of problems with a peer review process, but it's the best we have. So you want to start there. You want to make sure that this study was actually reviewed by other scientists objectively. But then you also want to go beyond that when you're doing the story and say, okay, I want to talk to other researchers who can evaluate this study better than I can. What people don't understand, I think the general public doesn't understand, is each scientific report, for the most part, tries to answer one question. And it doesn't always come to this causal conclusion. As an example, there's a study that maybe it was a year ago I reported on this, where
they found that babies born to women who were living very close to fracking sites had a statistically significant lower birth weight. They didn't say why. They could speculate why. But the interesting thing about this study was that they had this treasure trove of data that went back all the way before the fracking even began, so they could compare it before and after in these same areas. You know, in that case, it was actually done by an economist. And so I called other economists, other environmental economists, and talked to them, as well as other people in the public health field who have looked at these issues.
Do you have any advice for the average news consumer who sees a news story about new scientific research? And are there any, you know, red flags that they should look for or signs that they should pick up on that the reporter and the researchers have done their due diligence?
Sensationalist language is often a red flag. And also language, like Susan was alluding to earlier, causation, link, association. When I see things or percentages, a 50% increase in some death or something or disease, well, was it 0.00002% to begin with that doubled to 0.00004? So percentages can be misleading in journalism, potentially, as a reader, kind of keeping an eye on not the number itself, but the context of what that number is trying to convey. And that's something as journalists that we have to, you know, continue to work on and figure out, and the sources. And also, you know, when it comes to treatments and things like that, I'm always thinking about, we didn't talk on this aspect of scientific research, but, you know, how much do these treatments cost? You know, what's the money aspect and implication to some of these things?
That's another issue. Who stands to gain from this research? Even if you're looking for, you know, who paid for this research, but there's also a flip side, is who stands to gain from you doing a story about this quote unquote breakthrough?
For example, like a gene therapy or something that could be beneficial to people with a certain eye disease.
And again, yeah, there's a lot of things out there on the internet that are sensationalist. And, you know, you have to really evaluate based on where they are published. You know, is it a legitimate news source? Obviously, Scientific American is high on the list of something you can trust. But there's a lot out there. Industry does a lot of stuff, has a lot of groups. You know, the oil and gas industry, you know, they have their groups and they publish things all the time, and they often like will pay bloggers to write blogs, and those people aren't really qualified to criticize journalists' stories, especially those that are that have to do with science. So there's a lot of disinformation that's actually paid for by industries that have a lot at stake at squashing good science.
That was State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk talking with State Impact's Susan Phillips and Alana Gordon, a Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT, for the podcast Energy Explained. There's more online at State Impact Pennsylvania's website or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes are at trumponearth.org. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.